Hello, and welcome to the Time Wars Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast.
My name is John Mayo.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about one of the Time Wars novels by Simon Hawke.
In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we are going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on The Cleopatra Crisis, which is book 11 of the Time Wars series, so only one more after this. We're going to spoil not only this book, the previous books in it, in the series, and, I don't know, probably tell you more than you ever wanted to know about Roman society.
There's a chance.
This was another one of the books where, like the previous, the Hellfire Rebellion, where we learned a lot about pre-revolutionary America, particularly Boston and stuff like that, where we get a ton of kind of the politics, what's going on in this period of Rome. And it's
from the locals.
Huh?
From the locals, not just from a mission briefing.
Exactly. It's like we've moved into town.
Yeah.
You know, in a different way than in many of the other books. Because in the other books, we would be in 17th or 18th century England or France or whatever, and we know about the history, but it's not like we were watching it unfold and dealing with the main principles or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because here, I mean, Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, Brutus,
Mark Antony,
the main movers and shakers. I mean, they've got their own storyline going on.
Yeah.
And whereas in most of the other books, they are set at a place and time, this is deeply rooted in the place and time.
Yes.
And I found that interesting. And again, we're dealing with more historical figures than literary figures or authors,
mm-hmm.
which is part of what gave this and the previous book a little bit of a different flavor.
Yeah.
And in my mind, it felt like a deeper immersion.
Historical figures who were prolific writers. Both Sam Adams was a prolific writer.
No, true,
Caesar
true.
Was a prolific writer. So it gave the author that sense of firsthand experience with the historical figure to work from.
I guess the difference I'm seeing is with something like the Timekeeper Conspiracy.
Oh, and
or the Ivanhoe Gambit or the Pimpernel plot, the adjustment team is having to take set foot in and replace principles.
Yes.
Here, they're more on the periphery trying to keep an eye on the principles.
Yeah.
And kind of without them there, history is still going to happen.
Yeah.
And it gives it a different flavor, not better, not worse, but different.
Yeah.
And I felt, again, I got a better sense of the time and the place
mm-hmm.
just from the little almost sidebars of, well, people would throw their sewage out or whatever into the street. So watch where you're walking or whatever, things like that. And there was a line in the prologue that I highlighted because it's a difference in my reading of the story now versus when I was in college.
Hmm.
And just the little part I highlighted was, Rome was Rome. In college, I'd never been to Rome.
Yeah.
A couple of years back, we went.
Yeah.
I have a firsthand sense of the size, the space, the locale.
Yeah.
And Rome is Rome. Nothing else is. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. it's got its own flavor, style, and historical importance even to this day.
Yeah.
But much of the prologue was essentially Brutus having dinner with other notable Romans, and we learn a lot about Caesar. I mean, like a this is your life, Julius Caesar, except he wasn't there and it wasn't on TV.
Well, one of the things I picked up in the prologue, and it's just one of those differences that, I mean, it doesn't sound profound, but a very big difference between life back then versus the life we've lived our whole lives. Winter was a time of chills. Summer was a time of fevers.
No indoor heating and cooling. You very much at the mercy of it. And there was some mention of, you know, they'd be huddled up with their blankets or...
Yeah, at the mercy of the weather, needing something hot, soup, something in the winter to warm you from the inside.
And... Or to take the frigidium or whatever they call it.
Yes.
The cold water bath to brace yourself for the cold weather.
Yes, yes.
That's like getting shot with BBs to make yourself bulletproof. It just doesn't work that way, in my experience.
I don't know. There are a lot of people who do that polar bear swim every year, so some people still believe it.
Yeah. We got a pretty good setup about how one of these camps was laid out.
Yes.
And the size of it and the organization of it, and it was interesting.
Yes.
A lot of this is coming through a Captain Jonathan Travers, who is a temporal observer under the alias Lucius Septimus. And I was annoyed by that name, particularly the first name of Lucius, because we've got Lucas back.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have gone with something that's different.
Yeah.
Allowing Lucas to go by Lucius in something that's, oh yeah, that's... Because when you've got characters going by getting introduced and then giving a different introduction to themselves, it gets a little hard to keep track sometimes.
Yeah.
Again, when we're getting the description of that camp and stuff, it's divided in three equal parts, yada, yada, yada. And then inside of this, there's a broad street 120 feet wide. And I'm like, damn, this place is huge.
Yeah.
So just the sense of scale on some of that.
One of the things that Travers told us about Caesar was that he was a naturally gifted speaker who had studied rhetoric in the school of Apollonius of Rhodes. I'm pretty sure Apollonius of Rhodes is the one who wrote Jason and the Argonauts.
Well, that's interesting. And we've been to Rhodes.
Yeah. So I just found that to be an interesting little... Hmm.
There are those little kind of connective pieces between books sometimes.
Yeah.
I half expected later in the book when Lucas is having dinner with Julius for him to pose a question about the Scipio battle or whatever. Just because I'm sure he would have liked the bigger picture.
Yes.
I found it interesting that Travers was one of these long-term observers.
Yes.
This is the first book we've gotten them in. It makes sense. They've established them after the Time War with the other timeline had broken out.
Well, and they give a good explanation for what basically the payoff is for going through the unpleasant lifestyle of a long-term observer.
Well, the fact that you can write a book, you can teach about it, you become the expert yeah. on somebody like Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
And if you've got somebody, it's like who would just die for the chance, and you give them the chance.
Uh-huh.
And the comment of, well, we don't give them the anti-aging drugs because they need to age.
Yes.
They'll get them afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll be able to hopefully enjoy a long life or whatever. But also throughout the book, there was the whole of, we need this guy to die when he's supposed to die.
Yeah.
But I've known him now my entire life, sort of.
Yeah, that was very hard on Travers, who's, well, for half his life. And he was saying the future's become like a dream. I've been here so long. And I may intellectually know what's supposed to happen to him, but emotionally, he's become my best friend.
Well, and the whole thing is Travers is there when Caesar has a future seer basically warn him of, you know, he's going to get killed by a guy named Brutus, a guy named this, that, and the other, and, you know, basically gives him a couple of key points in his life.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, this doesn't seem right. This could be one of the special operations group people,
yeah,
you know, trying to prevent Caesar from dying.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting.
Well, and the seer gave him an explanation when he talked to him about it afterwards that to Travers came across as basically a paraphrasing of the principle of temporal inertia. And it was just kind of a, how does somebody in this time frame have that concept of time?
Well, and this goes to a point I think we've talked about in a few of the other books here, that the characters are good about acting on what they know and perceive, mm-hmm. not what the author knows and perceives.
Yes.
And in this case, well, how could they know? The only way we can think of is this.
Yes.
Now, maybe that's right. Maybe that's wrong. In this case, it turns out to be wrong.
Yes.
The guy just happened to be prophetic.
Well, and the prophet Lucan walks out of the camp into beyond a wall, into a wide open field. It takes Travers a minute or two to get clearance to
Guy
go through that gate, and poof, it was as if he had simply disappeared.
As if he had clocked out. Or if after he had reported to the plus time, somebody else had gone back and grabbed him to debrief.
Yeah.
And that gets a little into cause and effect aspect.
And I will admit, that occurred to me at the time. Did he clock out or was he grabbed?
I was figuring he clocked out.
I was torn.
Because it could have been Reese, it could have been, you know, Dracoff, it could have been a special operations group, it could have been the underground, it could have been the network. Those two are unlikely, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A lot of possibilities.
Well, and I'm glad you listed them all off, because they were all...
I think
all...
they all show up here.
No.
That was last book.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep it all straight.
Yeah.
I did enjoy one aspect of, you know, to cross the Rubicon, a phrase that would go down in history as signifying facing the greatest trial and passing the point of no return.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who, they recognize the phrase, but they don't understand the phrase.
Yeah.
I encountered that with somebody not long ago, and it's like, either you know it or you don't. Nothing right or wrong about that, but, yeah, when Travers is realizing this could really derail a lot of history if he doesn't die.
Well, let's just stop and consider the whole Caesar did how many things, like introducing the calendar we still use.
The fact that was never mentioned here surprised me.
Yeah.
I think that should have been a digression of, and the guys over in archives are still having a headache with that today. You got two, you know, you got to have this gap. You got to figure this in. Once we adjusted the thing, you know, we got the timeline, you know, something. If you're traveling in time, dealing with calendars and shifting calendars.
Yeah.
Just would be a royal pain. So for it to have been glossed over surprised me, disappointed me.
Well, especially since the reason he introduced the standardized calendar that was his is because in Rome, when a politician was in power and he was unpopular, the Senate would shorten months because the requirement for a month was that it have enough days to include all the mandatory feast and celebration days. It didn't actually have to include 29, 30, 31 days.
Imagine if our Congress had that power.
Yeah. Now,
this new bill is good for 2 years. 3 weeks later, it's been 2 years.
Now, the flip side, though, is if a politician was really popular, the only rule was that the month had to have enough days for all the feasts.
Didn't have to stop there.
Exactly. So they would end up with a 60-day month.
Yeah. And again, imagine if you're trying to count back the number of days to go land somebody at the right spot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and how much of that would have been accurately recorded, you know, 3,000 years later or what have you?
Yeah.
When we get to chapter one, there's an aspect here that almost makes me wonder if this book should have happened before the previous book.
I had that same feeling. I feel better that it wasn't just me.
And you had mentioned at one point also that there was another place where a character wasn't supposed to be, I think. So I think this is the first time where I think we're starting to get almost, I don't say continuity errors, but things that make you wonder. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, the penthouse at the Temporal Army's headquarters is under maximum security because Lucas Priest is living there and he's dead, or he's believed to be dead. And that, you know, suddenly this is now like a secret or whatever, a big deal, which they had alluded to in a previous book. But I'm also thinking there's half a dozen people beyond just the handful that they say should know.
Yeah, they either imply or flat out say that only Forrester, Delaney, Andre Cross, and Creed and Steiger know.
But that leaves out the Doctor from the last book.
Yeah.
Nielsen and Craven from the last book.
Yeah.
And obviously they leave out Dr. Darkness because, well, he's special.
Yeah.
But it's one of those, okay, now it's a secret or whatever. And that just, it didn't seem like they were being that secretive about it before.
Well, but they had talked about wanting to be secretive about it.
Yes, they had talked about it. They just hadn't been.
Yes. Agreed.
And we also got a couple other acronyms or whatnot to go with the long-term observers of like Chief Temporal Observer and some other stuff of how they've kind of reorganized the observation stuff since it's now frankly, most of the army. The other thing I noticed was when we went through some of the descriptions, Andre now has long hair to her shoulders or whatever.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Been letting that grow out.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Which isn't a big deal, but again, it's nice to see that these characters are not, here they are at a snapshot of time that lasts the duration of 12 books or what have you.
Yeah.
That they're slowly aging, they're changing, they're evolving.
Now, when they were talking about kind of the reorganization and everything, they were saying that now that we're aware of this other timeline, and instead of fighting against other countries within our own timeline, we're at war with the other timeline. Each of the timelines was faced with three prime necessities, and he just laid them out of mapping the confluence points, locating where you could cross over between the two universes. Both universes were confronted with the time war that they waged between themselves,
mm-hmm.
and dealing with that, and then safeguarding the temporal continuity of their respective timeline.
Well, find where you can cross over. Where can you engage the enemy? Where can the enemy engage you? The defensive side of protect your timeline, and the offensive time of can you mess theirs up?
Yeah.
Because that drains resources from. And if you think about that whole draining resources aspect, that goes back to the timekeeper conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
of doing just enough little things to disrupt but not destroy history.
Yeah.
To drain the resources dry.
Yeah.
And that was almost, you could argue, foreshadowing of what's happened here.
Yeah,
I certainly would agree. Didn't take it as such until now, but
yeah,
it's interesting. This is also what I think when we find out Lucas's built-in time travel thing from Darkness is burning out.
Yes, and he's ecstatic.
Well, again, I can see we're not wanting to you know, accidentally wake up one morning in Rome.
Yeah, well,
and I love how he comments on that and forces, well, about that.
Well, Darkness was unamused at how happy Lucas was that the invention was decaying.
I trust Darkness so much so that I think he may be lying about that and may just be turning it off.
There is that.
Because he couldn't trace the other people until he could.
That's true. Well, Darkness says he can once more revel in being the same depressingly ordinary clod he always was.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy Darkness. A little darkness goes a long ways, but I enjoy darkness.
Yes, yes.
Well, and then Forrester confronts Darkness.
Mm-hmm. You're from the future. What's going on? And Darkness was surprisingly revealing. I can't tell you much, but I am here for a reason. And certain of you have, are, or will be about to, you know, do important things.
Yeah.
Don't screw up.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that made me think, you know, they've got one, Simonac has one book after this to kind of tidy things up and leave it at a convenient pausing point or stopping point.
True.
And as I recall, you know, I don't remember any details about the ending, but not feeling like, geez, 12 books and I get to this, you know, kind of disgust.
Yes.
But it, okay, this is an end of a saga, if you will, not to say there can't be another.
Yes.
Because I want there to be more.
Yeah. Well, he's created a very rich universe.
Well, a rich universe, but I think there are also some stories with these characters that beg to be told. I would like to see this team of Lucas, Finn, and Andre have to do something during the time of the women's suffrage movement.
Mm.
Or some other setting where Andre has to take the lead.
Yeah.
Because she's never had that chance yet.
Yeah.
And I think it would be fun to see Finn and Lucas, not second guessing, but coaching,
mm-hmm.
and realizing she really doesn't need the coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a story that would be fun to get.
Yeah.
But just put them in a position where there's some places men just can't go.
Yeah.
I was hoping for a little bit more of that here with Cleopatra and stuff, but never really got that.
No.
There were one or two places Andre, I think, really stepped up to the forefront and got her place to shine a little bit, but nothing they couldn't have kind of found another way to do without her.
Yeah, I agree.
It took until, I think, chapter 3 for the team.
Well, chapter 2 is where Steiger refuses to go on the mission with them.
Right. Chapter 3 is when they get back there, but they get out there without Steiger.
Mm-hmm.
because he's reluctant to go for a variety of reasons.
Well, he claims it's because Lucas's built-in time, whatever.
The time thing could decay, puts the mission at risk, because he could just blip out accidentally. And
or be unable to blip out.
Or be unable to, yeah. It's a very viable concern.
He phrases it as Lucas is unreliable, but when he and Forrester are alone, he confesses, I want to go undercover. I want to be backup that they don't know about.
Which goes back to almost resetting up the Temporal Intelligence Agency, of which I think there is a definite need for. The Lucas being a potential liability, I think there are grounds for, given the events in, was it the Lilliput Legion, where he had, Lucas was the roadie or whatever with the electronics at the...
Yes.
And had the pounding headaches and all that.
Yes, yes.
It's like, okay, there's I think, legit cause for that. But I think his desire, Steiger's desire to go back undercover, and Forrester saying, well, take some time off. If you want to use it for that, great. But if it goes south, it's on you, not me.
Yeah.
In other words, I will give you the chance. Don't blow it.
Yeah.
Skip ahead to how that resolves, or
no?
Okay.
This is also the chapter where we, back in time, we find out from Travers, who's there in the moment, that Cleopatra sneaks in to meet Caesar, because Apollodorus, one of the slaves, and another slave bring her in a rolled up carpet, and kind of unroll the bedclothes, extra blankets and stuff, and there she is. And what was hidden stands revealed.
Oh yeah, what was hidden? Yeah, that was one of the things from the soothsayer, whatever it was, at the beginning, the prophet or the.
Yeah, that which was concealed shall stand revealed. So to Caesar, that seems so meaningful.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think this book has some opportunities for word of TV or movie to really have a couple of bit parts that aren't that big, but imagine having just the right guy as that prognosticator for Caesar.
Yeah.
I would almost go with Tony Amidala.
Yeah.
He could do the Roman kind of a look. He could do the vague yet meaningful. And the is he full of it? Is he really seeing the future? Is he manipulating the future?
Well, and I think that the scene kind of leading up to the prophet coming in, where Travers was saying basically, we know what to expect. He's a great general. So you tell him you will be victorious.
Yes, you will soon be on the battlefield. Well, really?
You know, you are a famous leader in command of basically a country or about to be. So we will tell you, you will meet a queen.
Certain things, it's like, what are the odds? I'm going to say pretty good.
Yeah. So it was kind of entertaining to have his whole, I've got a checklist of what I expect to hear. I'm standing in the corner. I'm hearing it. Yeah. 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 Say, what? That's exactly right. How'd you know? The Ides of March, you say.
Well, and that's why I think having somebody, because it's a small role.
It is, but it's powerful.
In theory, it's a day or two of shooting kind of a thing, but you need somebody who can just knock it out of the park and particularly have a I don't say a distinctive or recognizable voice, but a voiceover worthy voice.
Yes.
To where later on you could almost have echoes of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you're seeing, well, this happened, and then you get the audio reminder of, this is what the guy said.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, Caesar and Cleopatra are, I think, roles that, again, for the span of this book, having somebody who could do the you get rolled out of the carpet gracefully versus the thump, thump, thump as you keep going.
Yes.
Outtakes would be hilarious. Yeah, there are some opportunities with this that I think... this is one of the ones, though, that I think would be hard to film, because compared to a Victorian London or something like that, or a forest scene, ancient Rome, a little harder to find the locations for.
Agreed.
But it's also one, if I think, could be done well.
Well, fortunately, not much of this is at the Circus Maximus or at big crowded...
Yeah, but like the locations. Bath, the party that Brutus starts at, and a few things like that.
The bath would be hard.
It's one, though, that if you could really get a... If they could do it, they could really, I think, convey what was life like back in that time.
Yes.
And that, to me, would make it so worthwhile.
Yeah.
Because you bring history to life, and this is a part of history that, you know, yeah, we get things like, you know, Spartacus and a few of the movies and TV shows along those lines. But having something like the Time Wars gives you the possibility of doing, spend a little time in Boston, then ancient Rome, let's go to the Old West, let's go, you know, Victorian London, kind of the tourist guide to time travel, if you were the time travel's guide to tourism, one of the two. I was surprised it did take them a little while to go back.
Yeah. Well, and part of that is because we had Travers already back there.
Well, and the funny thing is, it's most books, I think it takes till about the third chapter to go back. Because we get a prologue or something set in the scene. We get a chapter
briefing.
Or two of the mission briefing and stuff.
That's true.
We're just throwing things a little out of order because part of the mission briefing here was what Brutus was getting about Caesar and whatnot. And frankly, what we get in one or two other places in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a good introduction to Caesar, his life and times.
Agreed.
And there was somewhere in this point, I forget which chapter it was, unsurprisingly, a mention of Scipio.
He's very popular.
Yes, I think he probably gets mentioned in maybe half the books.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this is where Travers reveals Travers greets our team. So we find out our team's cover identities.
Is this when we get the slaves?
Yes. We meet the four guys who have cover identities as slaves.
He introduces the slave of, this is, you know, whomever he is or whatever. You know, or this is Colonel so-and-so, and they give their Roman slave name or whatever.
Yes.
You know, it's like he's introducing them and they're correcting him almost. And I'm like, I can't remember all of this.
Yes. The chief temporal observer, I think, is Demetrius, who's from Sparta. Lieutenant Corwin is Korak from Gaul.
And most of these are short-term guys.
Yes.
So they'll be there for a year or two and then move on.
Yes.
Which has advantages and whatnot in terms of the logistics and what have you of running a temporal war. And I liked how they had a fairly well thought out game plan of, okay, Lucius, you're going to pretend to be, you know, Travers' brother. Andre's going to be the wife. You know, Finn, who's now shaven, and dyed his hair, I think. He looks a bit more Roman. He's going to be, you know, a childhood friend. Mm-hmm. You're all coming. You're doing this. And it sets them up to where they can kind of fit in where they need to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Travers has been writing letters home to his brother all this time, which are his field notes, basically.
Yeah, I thought that was a clever idea.
Yeah.
Well, and the fact that we've already set up Lucas as both a chess buff, a history buff, you know, how would he not have studied Caesar?
Yeah, exactly.
Again, particularly after having been in Scipio's army and whatnot. And
yes.
Knowing what war's like in that day and age.
Well, and this is where Travers reveals that, courtesy of Cleopatra, Caesar has an Egyptian bodyguard that he shouldn't have.
That gets mentioned a lot, both in terms of the political ramifications. It would be as if, you know, a modern U.S. president had, like, Russian bodyguards or something.
Yeah.
Or Chinese or what have you. It's like, well, that's a little odd. And then it really plays up also, you know, the potential influence Cleopatra's having. Is she a plant? Is she different? Mm-hmm. You know, is she changing the events?
Yeah.
Because all they know is they're on target for Caesar not to get killed.
Yeah. Well, at first, they're definitely suspecting, okay, Cleopatra's the one who put the guards in place. She brought them with her. Therefore, Cleopatra is probably from the alternate timeline.
That's one of their theories. And again, there's a certain amount of, can you get close enough to test any of these, and how do you test them?
Yes. Yes.
You know, I like there not being clear, clean-cut answers.
Yeah.
And
then we find out Steiger is back, and he's working with he thinks, underground member.
And the underground one is somebody who's connected in with the chariot races and all of that.
Yes.
Because Steiger's like, well, I need to meet so-and-so. Mm-hmm. A good way to meet somebody is to have them owe you money.
Yes.
Hey, can we rig this chariot race?
Yes.
Why, yes, I think we can do that. And that was interesting. And that's another one that, man, talk about filming this sort of a thing.
Yeah.
Doing a full-blown chariot race of any sort, not easy. This day and age, it would wind up being CG, I would imagine. And I would wholeheartedly recommend that because this is a rigged chariot race where we get the description of, and here's how it plays out, followed by the description of, and here's how it really played out.
And Andre was the one who understood the horsemanship and who did what to rig the race. And that all the charioteers were in on it.
There were aspects of that I thought were hilarious. One, she was picking up on a lot of this. Hey, he was poised to jump before this. He had his dagger out. And mm-hmm. just how eagle-eyed she is on this. And there was a line about her, and it may not have been until a little later, that there was something about that Sabinus or whatever creed that bothers me. Can't put my finger on it, but I swear there's something familiar about him. That really harkened back to Lucas in the second book.
Yep.
That lady there's something wrong with that face.
Exactly.
And Finn's like, well, I trust your judgment. And at this point, Lucas is like, well, I trust your judgment.
Yep.
You know, there's that aspect that I thought was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And it's surprising how much time the adjustment team spends/wastes tracking Steiger, not knowing it's Steiger, because he's gone cosmetic surgery.
Yeah.
This is one of those things where if I were to film it for TV, movie, whatever, or even hell, a cartoon for that matter, how do you handle that? Because if you've got live action actors, you want to hang on to them for the bit of it. But if they're undergoing cosmetic surgery, how do you convey to the audience, this guy looks different, but it's still...
This would be prosthetics.
So you're thinking actually make them up?
I would think actually, I mean, the same kind of process you put someone through to make them look like an alien. Only in this case, you're changing the cheekbones, you're changing the forehead and the hair color. Maybe even contacts to change the eye color.
If I were to go that route, I think you could do it and do it well. I would almost think you would want to reorder one or two of the events of this to where we see the race from Lucas and Andre's point of view. She reveals the stuff, and then we almost have a flashback to to Steiger going back in time, or getting the makeup to go back in time.
Yeah.
Kind of a what she doesn't know is, because if we see that up front,
yeah.
In other words, how do you sell the audience on this guy really does look completely different, but it's the same guy?
Mm-hmm.
And even in the 60s, they would do this sort of a thing in Mission Impossible all the time.
Yes.
You know, and there were a couple of times where it's like, okay, that is Martin Landau is a guy with just, he looks like an older Martin Landau. And there were one or two other times it's like, wow, that was really good.
Yeah.
And other times it's a fake mask.
Yes.
It's how do you give them the leverage to do all that stuff without having somebody trapped behind latex for an entire series or something?
Yeah. No, I agree. Well, and Steiger uses the fixed race not only to win money off Mark Antony, but to get Mark Antony to introduce him to Caesar.
Yeah. Well, and he did a really good job because it was lose the first race, lose the second. No, I can do this. No, I can do this.
Give me a chance to win my money.
And then like five races in, he double or nothing. Like he's getting more and more desperate. He knows how to con somebody.
Yes.
Of course, this is, you know, centuries before the con artist term or even the language for the con artist term is around. I thought that was some fun stuff. Again, seeing how that would get shot and selling all of that would be tough, but we certainly have the effects to do it.
Yeah.
But something that is an engineered chariot race disaster sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Be fun to see.
This is when they decide that Delaney should go undercover with the conspirators.
And this is where having him as a childhood friend whose views may depart a little.
Yeah, exactly. Because they realize, okay, Lucas is the brother. Whatever Caesar has heard about the mysterious brother, at this point, he's heard too much, whatever it may be, to believe or for the conspirators to believe that he would be against Caesar. So
yeah.
It can't be Lucas. And then the other thing is Andre says, I'll be the one to get close to Cleopatra. And on the one hand, they're going with the, we're not really in favor of that. We're going to go with it. That's the best plan we've got. But we wish we had a better plan, because sending you in alone behind a gate.
There is a somewhat overprotective aspect, given Andre is a capable warrior and has a warp disc.
Yes. And I guess the warp disc kind of trumps some things, but they don't know who's from this time, who's not from this time.
And that's fair. She could be going in to the enemy camp.
Yeah. And that's their fear. They're afraid that there are 10, 12 more soldiers of the enemy camp, and she's walking into their midst.
And in fairness, they have had, just a few books ago, some of their people get captured and essentially brainwashed.
Yeah.
With the Dracula caper.
Yeah. Well, and they're coming to recognize that in order to ensure that Caesar is assassinated, they may have to assassinate his bodyguards.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. To put time where it needs to be, they may have to kill quite a few people, but you can't kill too many people and you can't kill the wrong people. Killing Egyptians in Rome's easier than killing a Roman who may have unforeseen side effects.
Yeah.
You know, the trick is to do an adjustment without necessitating further adjustment.
Yes. Well, and then there was a hilarious conversation where, you know, I think it's Delaney saying, you know, it would tell us what we need to know, wouldn't it? And I think Lucas says, that's like standing up in the trench to find out if the snipers on the other side are paying attention.
Yeah. There's a, well, we could do this, but yes, then they'd kill us.
Well, and Delaney's response is, since when are you afraid of snipers?
Yeah, and he's like, oh, too soon, too soon.
Yes.
Because Lucas is still a little uneasy about having come back from the dead.
Well, and when Travers said, did I miss something? Lucas replies, it's another long story. I'd tell you, except I still don't know how it's going to turn out.
Mm-hmm.
The characters are very rich and three-dimensional. And that's one of the things I've really enjoyed throughout this series.
Well, and I like how Lucas, who has been a prime mover and shaker in the First Division, who's in charge of doing all these adjustments and stuff, is now keenly aware that he may be a temporal anomaly, and his very continued existence is at odds with his job and his purpose to exist.
Yeah.
And just, he's struggling with that.
Yeah.
Now, when did we get the discussion between Steiger and, I think it was Marshall? Because Marshall was the guy who was the chariot one.
Marshall is Martian.
Right. And then Marshall winds up informing the network about Steiger, the disruption, and about Lucas being alive.
Yes, I think you're probably into chapter 6.
Probably.
What's happening in chapter 5 is Martian has taken Steiger, Marshall has taken Steiger, to the dinner with Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Steiger's gotten close enough to Caesar, and Caesar invites Steiger onto his next campaign.
Steiger decides to take that because that way, if Caesar doesn't die on cue, he can march off to battle and die out there. It's close enough that they can work with that.
Yeah, so Steiger can make sure, you know, if the anomaly turns into a disruption, then I can make sure he at least dies close to the Ides of March, if not on the Ides of March.
I like the idea of having a fail-safe and that safety net, that backup plan. Having somebody undercover makes sense. Having somebody undercover without anybody on the adjustment team knowing.
Yeah.
Doesn't. But then say only Lucas or only Finn or only Andre knew. Then one of them is, oh, well, we don't need to worry about him. Well, how come we don't need to worry about him?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's a, how would you make that workable? How do you make that play?
Yeah. Then chapter 6, we have the team noticing Steiger with Martian, Steiger is Sabinus at this point, and realizing, wait, if nobody really knows him, if he suddenly appeared out of nowhere with money.
Yeah, he's rich, he's new, he's disruptive.
Yeah.
Let's keep an eye on this bad boy, you know, and see what he's up to.
And Delaney is now trying to get the attention of the conspirators and try and get invited in. So he's rabble-rousing.
Well, they throw a party almost for the express purpose of Finn having a falling out with Lucas publicly.
Yes.
Of, well, perhaps we shouldn't have somebody so authoritarian or whatever.
Yes. Well, and he asks, you know, is Caesar just going to set his secretaries up on the throne in his place while he goes off and does his war games? So there's quite a bit of interesting stuff going on there. Marshall takes Steiger back to his place and they have a celebratory glass of wine. Steiger really ought to be careful with his drinks.
Surprised he was not. I mean, he wanted to trust the guys, I think, what it came down to.
They were old friends. They went through the TIA together. He knew when this guy got out and went to the underground, and he let it slide because he thought, okay, this is the only way this guy can think of to retire.
Well, but, and he thought it was underground, not network. He missed that.
Yeah. But he thought old friendship trumped everything. He thought they respected each other. He missed a lot.
It's curious as to what specifically he would have missed, because Steiger's a pretty good judge of character, and a pretty, he plays things close to the vest.
Well, the way it came across from Marshall when he was talking to the guys from the network and a few other times was just a, you know, Steiger and Carnahan, Mongoose, they could turn down the network because they were, you know, the cowboys.
They were the thrill junkies.
Yeah. But for the average middle management guy and below, you couldn't say no to the network.
Well, you couldn't. It didn't make, even if you could, you wouldn't, because you're looking at the longer term of, I need to survive this.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Mongoose and Phoenix, Steiger's code name, they were too much in the moment.
Yeah.
Too much in the game, if you were.
Yeah.
And
I think it's because Steiger was always in the moment. That's why Marshall didn't trust him. Because, yeah, okay, you say in this moment that at the end of all this, you'll let me go on living my life. But who knows what you'll say in the moment when the case closes.
Well, and also you're actively trying to shut down the network. You've done this, you've done that. There's a pattern of behavior there to be had.
Yeah.
I did find it interesting that Marshall was so clued in on kind of current events.
Yeah, the network is definitely transmitting information somehow.
Well, again, Lucas being dead and so forth, and it's like, well, are you sure it's Lucas? It's like, I never met the guy.
Yeah.
Could be somebody else with his name. What do I know?
Yeah.
Which is kind of a funny comment, given that Steiger used somebody else's name at one point.
Yes.
I mean, depending how you look at it from the network and underground's point of view, there have been three Reese Hunters.
Yes. Yeah.
So, wee bit confusing if you don't pay attention.
I think the author does that a little on purpose, though.
Oh, absolutely. It's,
he's keeping us on our toes.
That's part of the fun of it, is he's not telegraphing. There is a lot to keep track of.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, there's some really good payoff.
Yes. Well, and speaking of payoff, we get some in Chapter 7 with how Andre decides to introduce herself to Cleopatra.
By essentially recreating the scene of how Cleopatra was snuck in to see Caesar.
On the anniversary of it by dumb luck.
Oh, yeah. And again, Finn and Lucas were not in favor of it, but it's like, yeah, we don't have got a better plan. Okay.
And they acknowledged it was a good idea in terms of it would play to Cleopatra.
Yeah.
You know, they recognized, yes, it's risky. They understood why the two agents who had to go in as the slaves delivering her were really not looking forward to it. Because it's kind of a, yeah, we're the cannon fodder. You guys just stay back safely and say, yeah, it's okay, honey, go on with your plan.
Yeah. That's one that I think would be interesting if it were to be filmed. I mean, how close do you have those two things mirror, you know? Do you not? Do you have certain things that are specifically different?
You can have it mirror quite precisely because Travers was there the first time, and Travers is her brother-in-law.
True. The other thing is, even subtle things, though, do you go with a choice of carpet that is similarish but not identical to, again, to kind of...
Do you go similar or contrasting?
I think you would want it to be evocative of, so not identical to, because that's crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
But something to where...
That's why I was thinking almost inverted.
Either inverted or the carpet kind of matched what Cleopatra was wearing, and therefore this carpet with what Andre's wearing.
Mm-hmm.
Something to show the individual style. I don't know.
Yeah. No, something to show you gave equal thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
It just seems like a hard thing to film, because you've got the lady in the carpet, you've got the slaves carrying it. Okay, I can handle that. But then, you know, how do you put it down without a oof, you know, kind of...
Well, you've got all that going on, but you've also got to keep Apollodorus in this.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to have Cleopatra kind of appear out of nowhere giggling and stopping Apollodorus from stopping it.
Mm.
So you've got a pretty broad shot going on.
Well, and also just having the suitably Roman decor or whatever, you know, how do you...
It'd probably be a courtyard.
Probably. There'd be some logistical challenges, but I could see it being kind of fun to see them pull off.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of stuff that, again, is not stuff you just see in typical movies and stuff.
Yeah. Next up is Delaney meeting with the conspirators in the public baths. Because apparently in the equivalent of a steam room in the public bath where everybody's naked, you can just conspire to your heart's content and nobody believes you.
Well, and I liked how Finn played the reluctant, well, I've heard talk before.
Yes, yes. Oh, and I loved it when he first walks in and they all look at him like, wow, you've got such a good body, you could be a slave.
Yeah, kind of a, just how much work do you do on that farm? So I like the work. Because here's a guy who's a soldier and he's, again, this would be one where the filming would have the strategically located steam or urns or pillars or or whatever just to show them not completely in the nude. But again, you've got somebody from the future with better health, better training, who's in top physical shape, and doesn't have the typical his clothes are a little wrinkled because he slept in them look. You know, this would be probably as quote unquote parade ready.
Yes.
As Finn ever gets.
That's probably true. Yes.
That's another one. Where do you find the Roman bath to shoot in, kind of, or how do you recreate that, and how do you make it play? Because again, a lot of this would, I would say, be the easier scene to shoot than the dinner party with Brutus at the beginning.
Yes.
All you have is a bunch of guys lounging around getting fed by their slaves talking about Caesar.
Well, and genuinely lounging around. I mean, they were laying on their sides on long couches. It doesn't seem easy to film. Their heads are only a few inches above the food.
Well, and with everybody kind of laying on their stomach on these couch bed things or whatever they are, you've got to have a certain size. How do you lay it out to where they can all converse?
Yeah.
Not have somebody's, you know, head up against somebody's feet or something, you know?
Well, they're in a square.
Oh, they're in a square. Still, it would be challenging, but it also, it sets the mood.
Let me rephrase my concerns about filming. This was a time when men did not wear pants.
Again, conveniently located.
Okay.
No up the toga shots.
I'm just saying.
There would be certain things you would probably have to tweak a little. The slaves may be a little bit more dressed than they might have otherwise been or some such.
Just saying.
But having a bunch of guys essentially sitting on couches eating grapes or whatever they were eating.
Yes.
Well, Caesar was a great general. It's like, I know this. I've been around. We've all been around. Why are you
Yes. And stop trying to claim he's my father.
Yeah, there were a couple of things where Brutus's ancestry or whatever was up for question.
Yes. Chapter 8. Yes, poor Steiger and Marshall have a falling out. Steiger was not amused. He knows he doesn't sleep that long or deeply.
Yeah, and he lets the guy go.
He does.
And I get the we're never talking again kind of a thing, but...
But he genuinely believed that they had a bond of friendship.
Steiger seemed a little soft. I don't know that the Steiger we had at the beginning as Barry Martingale would have done that.
I think this is the Steiger who went through the, I know Lucas died even if I wasn't right there when it happened. and Lucas came back.
I think it's less that than he has worked with Lucas, Finn, and Andre and seen what those three have.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And kind of longs for that.
Yeah. And you add that to the death of his brother.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just, I think he's grown and he's changed over the course of this. Yeah, but, you know, we all make mistakes. Marshall comes to regret having betrayed Steiger to the network.
Mm-hmm. How he thought that would go okay, I don't know.
I don't know. It was kind of funny, though, when Simmons from the network is saying, you know, you're being watched. What did you do to get somebody watching you? Nothing. I'm boring.
All I did was rig this chariot race.
Right.
Oh, is that all?
How could they possibly know about that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you haven't done anything else out of the ordinary? Then they must have figured it out. You know, I would like to give Simmons credit for one thing. He drew his laser and shot Marshall in the chest.
Yes, I noticed it was a chest shot. No decapitations.
Nice change of pace.
Just not very Roman to decapitate.
We won't discuss what's very Roman.
Fair enough.
Then we move on to Lucas having one of the most fascinating evenings of his life. An intimate party with Andre, Travers, Caesar, and Cleopatra. Poor Delaney wasn't invited.
I did highlight that exact same sentence. Because it does seem like that's a really big highlight of Lucas's life.
Yeah.
Or second life.
Yes. Yes. But I remember when poor Travers was having to tell poor Delaney he wasn't invited. And Lucas got invited because Andre's approach to Cleopatra was so original. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, that was kind of funny.
But for Finn not to be there, but then be commenting on the guards looked very capable. They're all very tall, big guys. I'm like, but you weren't there.
Now, that was after the dinner conversation where they tried to convince Caesar to get rid of the Egyptian guards. But yes, Delaney just appeared out of nowhere. And it was funny because we spoke. I had already finished the book and you were...
I hadn't gotten to that point yet and you had mentioned...
Yeah, you were just... you said two or three chapters before this. So I just asked you to, as you were reading, notice if somebody kind of appears in a scene that I... thought they weren't in.
The funny thing is, this would have been fairly easy to deal with, and I can see how you could shoot it. It's like, okay, they're having the dinner party, they're coming out, they go a little bit, and Finn joins them of how to go.
Mm-hmm. You know. I thought he was supposed to be with the conspirators while we were at the dinner party.
I believe you are correct.
So I mean, don't get me wrong. Finn had some great things to say in the scene he wasn't supposed to be in.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's easy for, I think, a writer to lose track of where people are when.
Yes.
It gets harder with the time travel stories. And again, we're 11 books in, and this is the only case I can think of where it's a wait a sec. I didn't think he was here now.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and it may have. You know, it's funny because there was one or two times I thought I had caught something like that in, it was a Star Trek Next Generation novel by Peter David. New characters in there, a lieutenant or commander or whatever, and he's telling Riker one thing, Troy another, Data another, and, you know, and I mentioned that because Peter David's at cons, I mentioned it's like, this is inconsistent. He's like, yeah, do you think the guy might have been lying? Like, oh. Well, yeah, I guess so.
Yes.
It's kind of, you were a little too subtle there, Mr. Author.
Yes, yes.
So I don't know that was the case here. I'm just saying,
yeah,
maybe there was something going on that...
Well, and it's entirely possible that a few lines or a scene got snipped where you're right, Delaney meets up with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, meeting up with them, not good. For anybody, because they turn the corner, they go down the alley, and did you know that Cleopatra is apparently issuing lasers to the Egyptian guards? Okay, fine, not Cleopatra, but somebody.
Lasers are Zat guns, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah, pretty Stargate much.
There. Yeah, when they suddenly get, you know, this, crisscross of laser beams or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they realize, wait, who's shooting whom with what, you know?
Yeah. Well, now, that's interesting, because Andre is trying to figure out what could we have done. She doesn't think they did anything suspicious. Lucas kept giving Apollodorus funny looks at dinner. And Caesar finally commented on it. And that was what brought up the conversation of, are you sure you should have Egyptian guards, etc. But then it turns out that the network people were kind of backing up our team because they don't want a disruption.
Yeah, and I forget where it was in this one, but I think, and it may be a little bit later when they do the raid, but the network operatives have, again, directional microphone on the house they're scoping out, and they're hearing, geez, they've brought in all the forces kind of a deal. And I'm like, how come our guys never bring that kind of equipment?
Because they don't want to get caught with it, because they play by the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and they're having the conversation back at Travers' house about what we do to give ourselves away. And by this point, they've picked up Steiger as well. And he's saying, you know, maybe it's something I did, maybe something Marshall did. Maybe they've already been through this before.
The concept of having been through it before I thought was interesting. Yeah. And we get a fairly good discussion around that of basically send observers in, have them document everything, report back, send your disruption team in. First thing they do is kill the observers so they don't report, because otherwise you get a paradoxical sort of a thing.
Yeah.
As if you wouldn't already get a paradox because you've killed them. But the quote-unquote saving grace of that is you've done it in the other timeline. So what if you get a paradox? As long as it doesn't mess up your plans, you're good.
Yeah. It became clear that this was kind of a one-way mission.
Yeah. And that they had to get everybody who was involved, lest they have other people running amok in their time stream doing just hit-and-run tactics.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had some interesting stuff there. What I found interesting about all of that was, you know, this whole thing that the special operations group caught on to him and, you know, was somehow taking somebody out or was doing this or was doing that or all of that. I'm like, you know, at this point, I hadn't seen any solid evidence that anybody from the special operations group was involved.
Yeah. I mean, this could be Dracov. I mean, I still don't. It felt like an assumption to me.
Going just to grab a little bit from later in the story where we find out the guy who gave the warning to Caesar legitimately was precognitive, which you've got to say, okay, I don't think it's likely, but let's toss that out as a theory. Then all of this is playing out because somebody was good at his job, and there is no disruption. And by sending all these people back, you are disrupting things. You know, again, the fact that it changed the number of guards and they're Egyptian, something did change.
Well, but the Egyptian guards have the lasers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not of that time period.
We also know that, and I forget when Cleopatra let this information out, that Apollonius or whatever.
Apollodorus.
Apollodorus was the one who had handpicked him.
Yes.
So that was kind of the lead. He's the lead suspect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing we get... We get Darkness stepping in around this point, and a really, really nice line of, what you're about to do, one way or another, will change the course of history. That you will affect a change is unavoidable. That you will affect the right change is conjecture, but you will affect a change. I'm like, yeah, no pressure, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and he's the one who tells them it's the special operations group from the parallel universe.
Well, and that we start to have a grandfather paradox that could involve two separate universes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things I've always thought the grandfather paradox, maybe not always, but I'm currently thinking the grandfather paradox is a needlessly complex setup for a situation. Because if you go back in time a week and shoot yourself, you then don't exist a week forward to go back, kind of. You could do a shorter loop than, you know, two generations.
Yeah, exactly.
But then it's, how do you short circuit the, well, somebody else does it for you.
Well, I like that, you know, Lucas points out this isn't a suicide mission for the people from the other timeline. They can do any darn thing here they want. You know, they can go anywhere in our timeline. They're now in a universe that they don't have to play by the rules in because it's not their home timeline. They don't care about the consequences.
Well, and that's another story I kind of want to see this team go through, is they've not been in the position of go to the other time stream and cause a disruption or whatever. We need to get them on the defensive kind of a deal. Mm-hmm. Because putting them, the quote-unquote good guys, in the position of doing something that's bad but not horrific, you know what I mean? How would they be playing the bad guys?
I'd actually like to see the opposite. I'd like to see them go to the other timeline to preserve their timeline because they are the good guys.
Well, one could argue they could do a disruption by making things better.
I mean, we don't know the future, so they could do it in the 27th century.
Well, imagine if they do it back in the 24th and divert their space colonies and they get to where their colonies are no longer where the bombs went off.
Yeah.
I mean, there are things they could do there that would be fascinating.
Yeah.
But also, it would be a complete reversal of what they typically have to go do of fix this.
Yeah.
It's a go change this. And what level of change would they be capable of making or not?
Yeah.
And would they back out at the last minute? It wasn't until, I think, chapter 10 where we get this Zeke Hollister.
Yes.
Of the Special Operations Group that I was convinced they were definitely there.
Yeah.
And it goes back to, we don't have a strict viewpoint tied to the lead characters. Matter of fact, we veer from that quite a bit, starting here with Brutus and stuff before we, you know, get into it.
Well, our characters frequently make false assumptions.
They do, but my point is, we don't have, in some narratives, you only are with certain characters.
Yeah.
You've got a very biased viewpoint.
Yeah.
Here we've got a little bit more, it's not the omniscient narrator, but it's certainly closer to that. It's much broader.
That's a good point.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have even seen this Zeke Hollister until he revealed himself to the team.
Yeah, that's true.
And then there was one other thing where they've pulled in the reinforcements, and they're like, 24 other people are in the room at this point because they've all clocked in. And it's like, suddenly, guess what? Hey, Lucas is alive. It's like, well, so much for that security.
Yeah.
You know, and I get that was nature of the beast when you bring him into a mission or whatever. And particularly since you've already set up, hey, when we've got this sort of a thing, the counterterrorist or counterinsurgent group or whatever's at the ready, it's nice to actually use them.
Yes.
The other thing I thought was kind of interesting there, other than them kind of just rolling with, well, I guess he's alive, was there were one or two familiar names. We Nielsen. See Bryant again. Nielsen, and I don't think we got Craven, though. Just Nielsen.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Nielsen's one that I would almost like to see him as part of another recurring team. And I've got a thought as to who would lead it, but I don't want to get into that just yet. I thought it was interesting that Nielsen was pointed out as he'd worked with them in London. But I'm like, yeah, and also in that last book we just read.
Are you sure?
Hellfire?
He was there. I'm just saying it still felt like the books were out of order.
Fair point. Fair point. The fact that more people know at the end of this than before this in this book of Lucas being alive versus the flip side on the other book. I am curious if the books should have were intended to be in the other order.
But they can't have been by the time you get to the end of this book.
Okay. You're talking about some of the events, particularly in Chapter 11 with Simmons?
I believe so.
As Simmons fired, Steiger made a flying dive to the left. The deadly blast from the disruptor barely missed him. He rolled and came up with his laser in his hand. Both men fired at the same time. How did you take that?
I took it as they both fired at the same time, and then later there was only one body.
Okay, how did you take that?
I took that as Steiger's being Steiger, and he went underground. He went somewhere.
Yeah, I was going to remind you, his code name, Phoenix.
Yes, yes.
Faking his death seems plausible.
But doesn't fit with how he was in Hellfire. Hence my,
no, I would agree with that.
Before that, as of that point.
I would agree with that. My question is, does Forrester learn of Steiger being alive, or does Steiger truly go completely underground?
Yeah.
And that's on the assumption he's alive, but given that we never found Creed's body, but we found Simmons from Andre, I'm taking that as, yes, the disruptor would have vaporized the body. I don't think that happened.
Neither do I.
The fact that we did not see it happen, if you will.
Yes.
To me means it didn't.
Yeah. That's my take.
And even if it did, let's face it, Darkness liked Creed.
That's true.
I wouldn't put it past Darkness to save Steiger.
To have magically activated the thought, activated whatever
it's
called.
No, just tack in, grab the body right before it gets vaporized.
Well, that's true, too.
He moves at light speed, this Darkness.
That's true.
So, we get quite a bit going on. We get things kind of...
Well, we grab hold of Cleopatra and Caesar and Caesar's wife. Yeah, we haven't mentioned that whole detail.
Yeah, there's this whole... Okay, we've pulled in the reinforcements. We're going to go hit two places at once with this carefully coordinated attack, and the special operations group is... It's like, what just happened?
Because we go on a bit of a rampage taking out the bad guys.
They had to.
Yeah. But what I really liked is with Darkness's help, they grabbed hold of Cleopatra, Caesar, Caesar's wife, and took them to a safe room in the 27th century.
They got them out of harm's way.
Yeah.
It's like, these are the objectives. Let's take them out of play. Mm-hmm. They're safe. Now we can go mow down whoever we need to.
Yeah.
This is one where it, I think, has less action than we get in, like, the Lilliput Legion and one or two other places where we've got some major action sequences. But this almost seems like it would be more satisfying action.
Yeah.
You know, you don't wind up with these little firefly, you know, laser, you know, tiny laser battles or whatever.
Yes.
You wind up with essentially a SWAT team taking out a Roman, you know, stronghold or what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
Roman palace or whatnot.
Now, Lucas does get shot, apparently.
Gets shot, gets hurt, but winds up okay. Mm-hmm. And I believe at that point they're kind of acknowledging, yeah, yeah, he's back from the dead. And we're going to take his name down and put Steiger's up.
Yeah, yeah. And Travers is going to dedicate his book to Steiger.
Which is an interesting... interesting choice. I'm, again, fully expecting Steiger to show up next book.
Well, and telling Lucas that he's going to dedicate the book to Steiger is how Lucas finds out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This book had an author's note at the end that was pretty extensive and was basically, hey, if you're not familiar with the history of Rome, here's some good places to go look. And I thought that was...
Oh, let's just slow down and say that they did mention and confirm that they went back and pulled Lucan the prophet.
Yes, they pulled the prophet, and that's how they realized he was a prophet.
Yeah. So, just to close out that little plot thread of, he did clock out and disappear.
And it also explained his comments of, I'm going on a long trip, I'm doing this.
Yes.
As from his... The prophet's perspective, everything he said held true.
Yes.
You know, it was really, though, the special operations group going and changing the guards or whatever, which I think was an easier sell because of the prophet, but is not to say that the prophet wouldn't have happened anyways.
Yeah.
It's one of those, that early warning may have just been coincidence.
Well, Trapper's whole point when he reported it was there's no mention of that prophet in any of the writings about Caesar, including Caesar's own writings. And he mentioned things like that. So that was part of why he put in the report. Why didn't Caesar mention it, especially when it turned out to have been so true?
Yeah. Because by the time he realized he was getting killed by Brutus, it would have been too late to go add it to the memoirs.
Man, those posthumous edits are hard.
I know.
Okay, so the author's note was really great.
I liked how it pulled in a lot of, here's how you could learn what it was like to live in Rome, how about this, you know, and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Because I do think part of the power of these sorts of books and stories is to get people interested in other time periods, broaden their worldview. Mm-hmm. And again, this Colonel Travers who goes and dedicates his life to living with Caesar to be his biographer, essentially.
Yeah.
Those sorts of people get inspired by the stories they read as kids.
Yeah.
You know, they become enamored with this, that, and the other. And having, again, part of what I love about this series is you've got some good sci-fi stuff to kind of crunch on. You've got some good action to deal with. You've got some strong characters that are growing throughout. But you also have very different settings to drop them into.
Mm-hmm.
Of, okay, how would you go handle this in ancient Rome versus, oh, we've got to go infiltrate the other opposing side in you know, pre-revolutionary Boston versus, you know, 12th century France or England or, you know, wherever.
Yeah.
I think the books show there's a certain commonality across time to just humans.
Yes.
Be them soldiers or whatnot. But also there's things play out a little differently here and there. Now, we've still got, at the end of this book, the adjustment team.
Yes.
Okay. We've got Creed presumably having gone off on his own. Maybe he's dead, maybe he's not. But we had him not dead at one point and then kill himself and not be dead in another book. So he covers the bases on that.
He does.
And Phoenix, that implies coming back.
Yeah. Or going to Arizona.
No. Well, six-gun solution, Western, could be Tombstone, Arizona. Okay.
See,
Tombstone, not Phoenix.
I covered all the bases.
Yeah. But we've got the underground. We've got the network.
Yeah.
I don't know that we've had the firmest of resolutions on Dracov.
I don't feel we have. And I was very disappointed that he was not ever considered or mentioned as a possibility here.
This may be the first book since he was introduced he didn't get a mention.
Yeah. Not even a, well, at least it's not Dracov this time.
Yeah, thank God, not another hominoid or whatever.
Yeah.
They didn't even come up as a possibility.
Yeah.
It almost as if this is an idea he had had earlier on, but held off.
Yeah. Because the only consideration they had for Cleopatra was that she came over from the other timeline. Was brought over from the other timeline. But not that she was a hominoid replacement.
Yeah. Interesting. The hominoids themselves, are we going to give any... Do we need closure on that? Rhys is still... No, he's back in the other timeline, so yeah. We could argue he's closed off. I'm expecting the six-gun solution, the final book of the 12, to end with kind of they're back at Forrester's room having drinks and all live heavily ever after as much as whoever survives can.
Yeah.
What else needs to be resolved? I mean, they've got to close off the time war between the other timeline in this.
Do you feel they need to make a statement of any kind on Lucas and Andre's relationship?
Yeah, I think they need to solidify them as a couple, and they need to acknowledge it and move on.
I mean, here they were referred to as going undercover as married, and that kind of never really came up other than that's the reason the two of them are in the same place at the same time.
Whereas it was the subplot of the previous book.
Yeah.
Which, again, makes them feel a little... And there wasn't room for that in this book.
That I'll agree with. This was a plenty full book.
There are aspects of that would be interesting to get kind of Simon Hawke's kind of recollection and his process for the books.
But that's also why I was pointing out, because these are on the Kindle, they're in Kindle Unlimited. Kindle Unlimited is a great avenue for those novellas. They're 100, 150 pages. And they give you the opportunity to put a couple chapters, a small book between books. Or yeah. To do little, you know, Lucas and Andre tried going on vacation and meeting his family. And it wasn't just that she didn't know as a displaced person what to say or how to interact with his family. He felt like a displaced person and didn't know how to interact with his family.
Really, have we heard anything of his family?
No, we haven't. And that's why I would love to see it explored.
Yeah.
But that's also why I was saying that I don't feel these are character-driven versus... If I were going to say character-driven versus plot-driven, I would not say character-driven.
Totally plot-driven.
Because we only get what is relevant for the characters. We needed to know Andre had a brother. We needed to know she was an orphan. Those things were important to the plot and the story and the arc that was unfolding.
Well, the proof in the pudding there is how many things we learn about these characters many books in as it becomes relevant.
Yeah. And it's not a fault. I enjoy these books immensely, but some books are driven by character details, and those details seem to open the doors. And you say, oh, what a coincidence. The chess lover has to play a game of chess in order to, you know?
But that's where I think the first book set an expectation or two that weren't quite met. Half that first team doesn't make it back.
Yeah.
And you could argue whether we've lost anyone since. I mean, there's certainly Lucas did die, but he came back.
We've had a lot of casualties, but they haven't been the primary team. That's why we've been bringing along the Nielsen and Craven type assistants.
Well, particularly in, it was the Dracula caper. We got the seven assistants, five of which die.
Yeah, that was a high death toll for the good guys.
But there was never a point at which we pull in a specialist.
Hmm.
You know? Imagine if this had been a case where they needed somebody who was a qualified Roman orator to argue the legality of this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
So they bring in one of their legal guys. I was a lawyer before I signed up, and well, I've now got, you know, ancient Roman in my implant, so I can talk about that. I don't even think they used the term implant once in this.
I don't think so.
So there's certain things that are still around, but are either taken for granted or falling by the wayside. I would certainly expect Nielsen to show up in the next book.
Mm.
He's the gun guy, and we're going to the six-gun solution.
Yeah, we can hope.
Major mistake if they don't. Flip side, we've also not had, you know, the self-directing arrows and whatnot from the first books. Some of those have fallen by the wayside.
It's funny you say call in a specialist. Entertaining stories would be, we need a specialist to help us in dealing with the other side, and they convince Reese Hunter from the other timeline that it's to his benefit to help them again.
I would expect if they broker peace with the other side, Reese has to be involved.
Yeah. But the other thing is, it would be entertaining to me if Reese Hunter got sent over with, we need a specialist, and it's, we need Lucas, Andre, and Finn.
I'm hoping there's some sort of viable brokering of the peace between the timelines. I don't know how you can do that, plus whatever story would be the main plot of the final novel.
I kind of feel like the brokering of the peace is the two of them realizing, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. We have a common enemy.
Of Dracov? Yeah, but then how do you know you've taken care of him?
He's made it so you never will, and that's what unites you.
Although one would think with the resources of two timelines, they could track the history of one guy.
You would think.
Yeah,
the
I'm
Dracov
curious.
Spectre.
I'm curious where they go with that. And the other thing that has to get resolved in the next book is darkness.
Mm.
What is his whole game plan been about? And I'm hoping it's the brokering of peace between the two timelines. So, one novel left out of the 12. Looking forward to it again. I've been enjoying these. Each book has had its own kind of tone and style.
Mm-hmm.
The last two have been a bit more diving into the specifics of the geopolitical aspects of a certain time and place. I'm expecting the next one again to be more genre-ish of the Western than a specific.
Mm-hmm.
And I question if it'll feel as immersive because there's not the same level of politics or multiple primary players in a key moment in history.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of ways it could go, and hopefully we'll get at least one good showdown at the OK Corral or draw at High Noon or whatever.
A few tumbleweeds?
A few something. I would imagine Lucas would be at the center of that, but I really don't know that he's the character I would put there.
See Finn getting baited into a gunfight and Nielsen fighting it for him.
Be interesting. Nielsen doesn't show up, I'll be disappointed. That much is a given. He seems like he would live for that mission.
Yes.
So anything else on this book? Are we good?
I think we're good.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.